You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues of our lives. And our guest for this hour is Wales Brown. Wales, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's have just a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of who you are, or what the labels, I mean, it's not a who you are so much now, it will be that later, but what are the labels that you choose to wear in light of the world that we live in?
Well, I'm a language enthusiast. Uh-huh. I teach languages, and I analyze languages, and I translate languages. Mm-hmm. And I can say I'm also a human rights worker, mm-hmm. and I'm a music enthusiast. I can say I'm also a cook for my wife.
Uh-huh. And you're a cooking enthusiast. That seems to catch.
I wouldn't quite say I'm a cooking enthusiast. I don't teach other people about cooking. I just do it so that we have something to eat in the house.
Yes. So do you want to say a little bit about this first song that we're going to play?
Okay, it's a Macedonian dance played on the reed pipe and the drums, and it's called Teško to, which means the difficult dance. There's another one that's called Lesno to, which means the easy dance. But I wanted to start off with it because once upon a time I had a radio show, or I shared a radio show, and this was our theme song.
Oh, really?
And the radio show had unexpected consequences much later. So why don't you put it
sure,
on,
I
and
will.
Then I'll tell you about it.
We are going to go, yes. Teško to.
Teško to.
Okay, you're listening to Made of Clay, and our guest this morning is Wales Brown, and that was Teško to.
Teško to, a Macedonian dance. apologies to any Greeks or Bulgarians listening, because if you're a patriotic Greek following your government's line, or a similarly faithful Bulgarian, you're supposed to believe that there aren't any Macedonians. But in fact, I've been there and I've seen them. There are Macedonians.
To this day.
Yes.
Yes.
The story. In the 60s, I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, studying at MIT, and I turned on the radio, and there was a show on the MIT student radio station called Music of the East that had all sorts of folk dance and folk songs from other countries, and I phoned in and got to know the presenter, and she invited me to come on and help out with the show. So from then on, it was my show, too. So I was a DJ or assistant DJ.
Wow.
And her name at that time was Jean Ault, because she was married to a guy named Ault.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, she moved from Boston to New York City. And she moved into an apartment house on Bennett Avenue, on the a little bit north of the George Washington Bridge.
Mm-hmm. I know the street, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there she met a family whose daughter was studying Slavic linguistics, and said, "Oh, you must know Wales Brown." And Teresa, the daughter, said, "Well, no, I don't. He studies Slavic linguistics." And Jean said, "Yes, you should watch out for him." And a couple of years later, Teresa actually did run into me and said, "I'm supposed to tell you hello from Jean Ault." And it turned out that Teresa and I had a lot of things in common. It's not just that we were studying Slavic linguistics, but we were studying some of the same minor and not well-known languages, like Belarusian. So that was how we got together, thanks to Jean Ault. And that was an extra bond, because Teresa's name really is Ault. So she was very struck when Jean said, "Oh, my married name used to be Ault."
That's very funny. That's very funny. And you said also that this music, this song, was the theme song from your show.
For the Music of the East show, yes.
Okay. And what is this music's place in the repertoire of folk music and dance music?
Okay. Let's say it like this. There was a big folk song revival in the United States in the late 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. And lots of albums from all over the world recorded that came,
Yes, yeah. And until then, there had been ethnic music recorded in the United States, but nobody would buy a Greek album except for Greek Americans, nobody would buy a Russian album except for Russian Americans. But in the 50s, not only did English language folk songs become popular again, from the Appalachian Mountains or from England or from Scotland or from Ireland, but also sort of mainstream white American English-speaking people became interested in folk songs of other nations.
Yeah. I have some Bulgarian and Romanian and records from that time period. I had a relative who had a show on WQXR in New York City, and the record companies would send them free ones to try to get them to play them on their show.
We could only occasionally bring that off on the MIT radio station. Right. But I was also fortunate enough to go to a summer camp in the mid-50s that taught us a bit about folk dancing as well as folk songs, and so I could dance Balkan kolos, I kept up with that more or less through the 80s or 90s, and here in Ithaca, and my knowledge of Balkan languages turned out to be useful to folk dancers, because they would ask me, what do these words mean that we're singing along with the dance? And I was able to tell them. And Patrice also came out of that tradition to some extent, she still dances, although not to Balkan folk music. She's a lot lighter on my feet than I am, but so I usually sit down and watch her dance.
Right. Well, for a dancer, there also should be a watcher.
Yes.
Or a few.
Yes. Yeah. So a bit more about the folk song tradition. I was lucky enough to be living just outside Washington, D.C. in the early and mid-50s. And so one of the things I'm proud of is that I accidentally got to hear Libba Cotton in person, Elizabeth Cotton, who wrote the song Freight Train.
Yes.
And I wish you would play that, and I'll say a word about how lucky I was.
Okay, and here we're going to go. And this is an old-style recording.
Mm-hmm.
Libba Cotton and Freight Train. And our guest this morning is Wales Brown.
Mm-hmm. A word about her. As I say, I was very lucky to be able to hear her in the mid-50s outside of Washington. The folk song revival was in full swing, and we had gatherings called Hoot Nannies, or Hoots for short. And she showed up at a hoot with her guitar, which she played left-handed. She was famous for doing that. Is not fingering with the left hand, fingering with the right hand, and plucking with the left.
Did she turn it? Did she string it back the other way?
I think she did. Yeah.
Because Jimi Hendrix just turned it over and played it the other way.
Okay. Well, she had sung songs and played guitar as a little girl in a black family in South Carolina, maybe North Carolina. And then as a middle-aged person, she was in Washington, D.C., and she found herself helping out in the household of the Seeger family and realized they were cultivating folk music. And she recalled her youthful singing days and brought Freight Train back, and they recorded her with a great enthusiasm.
Yes. Wow. So now, you've told us a lot about these kind of important connections and these pieces. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I know you like to ask people, who are you? What are you? But it's hard for me to.
What brought you to Ithaca?
Okay, that's much easier.
Yeah, what brought you to Utica?
I was already working on Slavic languages. Mm-hmm. I was in Yugoslavia. An old friend of mine from my student days in Cambridge, mm-hmm. Who mainly worked on Russian, came to visit me in Zagreb. It was either before or after a visit to Russia that he was making, and mm-hmm. and was very taken with Yugoslavia. He said he hadn't believed a Slavic country could be bright and warm and sunny and cheerful, because mm-hmm. he was more used to Russia and the Russian weather and the Russian mystique. Yep. In any case, he was teaching at Cornell, had been for a couple of years, and said, "Hey, we have an opening in the department at Cornell. You should really apply for it." And that was sort of late fall, and within a month, I came back to Massachusetts for Christmas and flew into Ithaca and gave a job talk for the opening. And again, through a piece of luck, the opening was to teach Slavic languages, mainly mm-hmm. Russian. I gave a talk. That's what you do when you apply for an opening.
When you candidate,
you give a lecture.
Yes,
So I gave a lecture about relative clauses in Slavic languages, and one of the older professors asked me about relative clauses in Romanian, which is not a Slavic language. But I happened to be working on a project, and people in Romania were working on a similar research project. Mm. So I was able to say, "Oh yes, in Romania, you say, for example, omul cel văd, the man that I see him, mm-hmm. omul pe care îl văd." The man that I see him, and old Professor Agard was highly impressed, and mm-hmm. maybe it's because of that I got the job.
No, it's funny how those kinds of connections which come out of the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
For one of the connections that I have to the former Yugoslavia was for 6 years living in the Bronx, I wrote my rent check out to Kosovo Realty. And there was an enclave of Kosovars who had purchased old rundown buildings and began to rehab them and rent them out. And they drove buses in the day for the various Liberty Lines and bus folks, and they got their health care that way. And in the evenings and weekends, they worked on these buildings, and they were, you know, glad in the Bronx, across from the Bronx Zoo and the New York and the Botanical Gardens to mm-hmm. have me and my partner move in. And, you know, mm-hmm. we lived there and we got to know. And in the entryway of that building, unlike, I'd never seen this before,
uh-huh.
They put up symbols from Islam, mm-hmm. Christianity, Judaism, mm-hmm. Hinduism, and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. on the wall in the building as you came in. So, and there were people living in the building. There were 18 distinct first languages in this building of 72 units. And they, in some sense, honored them all.
That was very good of them. The Kosovar Albanians are mostly Muslim, not
yes,
all.
Yes, yeah. These were secular Muslims, what we would call them.
Yeah, but they come from a tradition. Well, the Albanians in general are a bit of an odd man out in the Balkans, because the rest of the Balkan peoples have a strong tendency to identify you first and foremost by your religious membership,
mm-hmm.
whereas the Albanians have a feeling, oh, we're all Albanians, and some of us are Catholic,
right.
and some of us are Orthodox Christians. So,
right.
So that seems strange to the Serbs or the Greeks or the other neighbors.
Interesting. But that was definitely the attitude that these guys had. And after Tito died, they got out as quickly as they could because they felt that things were going to fall apart.
Yes, we have. My wife and I were fortunate enough to live there part of the time before Tito died,
mm-hmm.
and in those days, people from Kosovo did identify with Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
They could tell they were having a better life
yes.
there than their relatives in Albania were.
Right.
And I remember being on a train going through Germany in I guess, summer of 77 or 78. So Teeter was still alive. And my wife and I got talking to the guy who pushed a push cart with food and drink through the train corridor. We discovered he was from Kosovo, and we could speak Serbo-Croatian to him, and he was happy to speak Serbo-Croatian to us, and he invited us into the compartment that he had reserved specially for his push cart. So we had a much more comfortable ride than the vacationers standing in the corridor.
That's great. That's great. Yes, that's
wouldn't happen. Wouldn't have happened a few years later.
Right. Oh yeah. So. What have you, you know, what keeps you in Ithaca? I mean, are you still teaching? Are you?
I'm still teaching. I'm gradually retiring, but I like teaching languages. It's really a great delight when one of my students says something intelligible in one of my languages, and sometimes it's because they speak the language already from home or from being in the country. Sometimes it really is because I've imparted it to them.
And how is it that you discovered your love of languages, especially Slavic languages?
Well, it was sort of a hobby back when I was in junior high school and high school, and I learned a little bit of... first of all, I had to choose in my particular school between taking Latin and taking French because the classes met at the same time. And I did take Latin, but I was interested in French, so I read some books and learned some French, and I read some Spanish books and learned a bit of Spanish, and some German books and learned some German. And then at a certain point, my wife knows the story very well, I often tell it to people, I said, well, I haven't learned any of these languages really well. I should try again and be more serious about it. And there was a kid from a Russian family in my school, so I thought, well, maybe he could help me learn Russian. And he did precisely one thing to help me learn Russian. He stole a book from his family's bookshelf, and the book was called Samouchitель Anglийского языка, which means self-teacher of the English language. So it was designed to help Russians learn English. But I sort of turned it around and looked to see how much Russian I could learn from it, comparing the Russian with the English language sentences.
And where were you at that time?
In Bethesda, Maryland.
Yeah. That is, one of the things that's impressive about teenage kids is they find all sorts of ways to learn something, and it's better the more roundabout that you can do it, because it has this sly quality, and I'm in on something else that the rest of the world doesn't quite get. It's neat. So what would you like to go to next for music?
How about Clara Petralia, the Brazilian folk singer, because there's a bit of a story about her.
Okay. And this is Pingo de Agua?
Pingo de Agua, a drop of water.
Pinga, pinga, pingo d'água lá na praia da lagoa. Pinga, pinga, pingo d'água lá na praia da lagoa. O amor quando é de gosto, ai meu Deus, que coisa boa. O amor quando é de gosto, ai meu Deus, que coisa boa. Coração arriba, arriba, quando não puder descansa. O destino de quem ama é viver só de esperança. Quem disser que o amor não dói, desconhece o amor então. Ame alguém e viva ausente, para saber se dói ou não. Pinga, pinga, pingo d'água lá na praia da lagoa. Pinga, pinga, pingo d'água lá na praia da lagoa. O amor quando é de gosto, ai meu Deus, que coisa boa. O amor quando é de gosto, ai meu Deus, que coisa boa. Amanhã eu vou-me embora, não despeço de ninguém, só despeço da morena, porque sei que me quer bem. Morena cor de canela, corre da pomba juriti. Tu não sabes, ó morena, o quanto eu gosto de ti. Pinga, pinga, pingo d'água lá na praia da lagoa. Pinga, pinga, pingo d'água lá na praia da lagoa. O amor quando é de gosto, ai meu Deus, que coisa boa. O amor quando é de gosto, ai meu Deus, que coisa boa.
Okay, Clara Petralha, the Brazilian folk singer from the 1950s, actually Brazilian-American because mm-hmm. she spent some time in Pennsylvania and New York. And when I was a teenage kid learning Russian, I had one LP by her.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went off to study at Harvard, and I discovered there was another LP by her, and I really wanted to get it, but it was sold out. So I put an ad in the newspaper asking if anybody in Cambridge had a copy of it. And guess what? Somebody replied to the ad and said, I won't give it to you, but you can dub it. So, so I have a tape of the second album.
That's funny. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, Wales, how have you changed over the years?
Okay, when I was a young, let's say, teenage language enthusiast, I was most interested in the languages and their structure and makeup, how they functioned. And mm-hmm. I'm still just as interested in all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But after going to visit some countries and work on languages where they live, mm-hmm. I've come to realize that you cannot really separate the languages from the people who speak them, from the conditions in which mm-hmm. they are spoken, or they've come to be spoken, or they've come to be cultivated.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
and one word about that as a linguist, there's a notion of standard language or cultivated language, and we never think about it much in English except for thinking about proper usage as opposed to bad English.
Right, but, or when you sometimes it's an implicit comparison between British English and American English
yeah.
is the fallen version, as it were.
Yeah, the British do think that, but most of the territory of Britain doesn't naturally speak standard
That's
English.
Right. Yeah.
They have their own local forms, mm-hmm. and then they learn standard English more or less in school or from listening to the BBC. But in many countries, that's been more of a conscious process. There are local forms of speech, local dialects, and then somebody sits down and makes a standardized form that everybody in the country will then be asked to learn and use for official purposes.
Right, and this basically didn't happen until after 1800 with the rise of modernity and the
standardization. In many places, it didn't happen,
and,
yeah. In Germany, it happened earlier because Martin Luther sat down to translate the Bible,
right.
and he wanted a generally intelligible version of German. But say in my
Wycliffe in England,
yeah,
too. Yeah.
In most of my Slavic countries, it happened after 1800.
Mm-hmm.
The Czechs had to revive an earlier form of Czech from two or three centuries before in order to have a standard. But the Croatians sat down to and chose what sort of standard they're going to have.
What's really fascinating is that I'm seeing kind of a fundamentalism with language here
mm-hmm.
that parallels a rise in religious fundamentalism in those same centuries, and also a scientific fundamentalism, which is all kind of part of the modernity effort at certainty and structure.
Okay, there
and
is something
that's a,
in
that's
that.
And that's a very... There, that's, I had never seen how these
there
things
is something
line
in
up.
That. Yeah, they...
But the reason I raise that
yeah.
is because you—that's where you started interested in the structure, but you moved
mm-hmm.
to the people and the culture and the way that they make it their own and may have always made it their own.
Yeah.
Well, how did that transition happen for you?
Oh, I went to Yugoslavia mm-hmm. and saw that people were indeed squabbling about the language.
Mm-hmm.
On what basis were they squabbling? Well. A lot of it was on the basis of their own national identities, I say that in the plural because Yugoslavia had different national groups living in it. And then,
almost a dozen. Yeah.
And so and there was Serbian, and they had their Serbian identity, and part of it was downplaying the Croatians. And why should the Croatians have a separate version of the language? Who were they to have a separate version?
Right. And then you had to the north the more affluent Slovenians who had their own.
Well, they really do have their own separate language, no doubt.
But they had their
own
economy, too, that was much more advanced than.
Yes. They were they used to be in Austria-Hungary, and there was something of a backwater, but it was good to be even a backwater in Austria-Hungary. It means you came into the 20th century more developed.
Right. So what is it about these squabbles, these efforts of people to own their language and to change their language that holds your attention?
Well, practical things and theoretical things. Practical things, if I'm going to teach this language to anybody, I have to figure out which version I should get them to learn.
So as a good messenger, you have to know what the message is.
That's right. And fortunately, two friends of mine put together a really nice language textbook beginning a little over 10 years ago. It's called BCS, Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian, and all the material is presented in three columns. And you can see they're almost identical, but not quite. And
right.
So whichever student is going to be working in Bosnia, I tell them, follow the Bosnian column.
Be aware of the other, but follow that one.
Yes, and somebody who has a Croatian husband or girlfriend should follow the Croatian column. And somebody who has contacts with Serbia obviously needs to follow the Serbian column. But they are close enough that all these students can work together in class, and different enough that it's instructive to look at the differences.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And do you and is the attention to the difference, does that launch you into a different sort of relationship with the students or with the peoples when you go to learn?
Yes, the people can tell that I'm conscious of some of these differences, and. And I can ask them more or less intelligent questions about it. And I'm especially sympathetic to the Bosnians, I would say, because they have very much gotten the short end. There are Serbs, everyone has heard of them. There are Croatians, everyone has heard of them. And then who are the Bosnians? And in many cases, if you ask a Serb, you'll be told, oh, they used to be Serbs, but they sort of went away from us. And similar things from Croatians, but the Bosnians have more of a sense of their own identity or identities, and they're used to a structure where there are multiple religions and ethnic identifications right in the same country of Bosnia. So that is very interesting for me. I translated a Bosnian Muslim poet who in one of his poems used the simile, like a little girl getting dressed up for First Communion. Now, that's not a Muslim concept. It's a specifically Catholic concept. But in his tradition, he could reach for it and use it.
Yes. And he knew it. He really knew it. Yeah. So this is kind of a segue to, you know, what are the issues that you care about today? What is the impact in the world that you want to kind of, what do you want to be engaging in the world to maybe impact or?
Okay, well, I say I'm a human rights activist, and I'm in the local Amnesty International group, and this is one of many human rights organizations. It's one I'm especially fond of because it works on a variety of problems in many, many countries, and occasionally I've been able to use my language knowledge to help it out. It does a lot of its work by writing letters. Another member of the group and I were at the Richard Thompson concert last night, collecting signatures from the Richard Thompson fans. And I have some letters that I hope I can get you to sign after the program. On human rights, things are improving to some extent in the world because there's more or less good agreement across the different countries about a minimum set of human rights. This has come about mostly since World War II. The Genocide Convention was put forward and signed by a lot of countries, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the United Nations in 1948. And Amnesty sort of takes that as its charter. There's a list of 30 articles that everyone should agree with. And in practice, we can catch countries not agreeing with them in their actions, but then we can write and say, how about this? You're supposed to believe in Article 19. And then,
in your work with Amnesty International, what are some of the campaigns that you worked most aggressively on in terms of the issues?
Okay. Amnesty got started to help out prisoners, political prisoners.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And which is why the symbol is the candle with the barbed wire.
The candle with the barbed wire, yes. And it gradually expanded to take in more and more of the basic rights. This may or may not be a totally good thing, because there are many other human rights organizations, and there may be things we could leave to Human
other
Rights Watch
or
the Anti-Slavery Society. We work on political prisoners, and we work on non-political prisoners because we don't think they should be tortured or kept in solitary confinement or subjected to the death penalty.
Right.
So even if
truly
you are
cruel
a,
and unusual makes you at a political cause, even if the original sentence wasn't.
Even cruel but usual.
Right.
Even if you are a multiple murderer, we don't think you ought to be subjected to the death penalty.
Right. Yeah.
More recently, we've got into sort of broader campaigns for economic justice or social justice or expansion of health care to different populations, especially women. We've been working on health care for women in many places around the world. And this is all very important. I'm not sure that Amnesty is the best group to be doing it, but we are doing it. So.
Right. And
so one of the things I'm going to ask you to sign is about health care for women in Nepal.
Yeah. And this is, one... Amnesty and many of these rights organizations struggle to find a niche between people's informal lives and their formal organizations. And a lot of times it's tempting to become highly organized in order to challenge a structure that's in itself highly organized. It's reminiscent of what you were saying about languages. And when we do that, sometimes we can affect the organized thing for the better. But sometimes we destroy the capacity of our informal communities to be flexible and responsive and kind of on task with where their people's hearts are, and we overstretch them. And that's and one of the things that we have modernity has almost systematically destroyed our understanding of how informal community works as a very viable counterbalance or alternative to mass society or highly organized or rationalized endeavors. And we are at a kind of a time where things are falling apart environmentally, humans rights wise, and there may be a whole set of skills that we have lost touch with.
Well, the environment is suffering badly, yes, but I don't know if we can say it's suffering because of the falling apart of society.
No, it's because...
Let's say it's suffering because of the growth of business organizations.
Of highly organized use of it without a system or structures that are outside that system.
Now this brings me around to some of my views on religion, because one... slight digression, my views on religion. One of the things about teaching Slavic languages is I teach a couple of medieval Slavic languages, and what we have to read in medieval Slavic languages is translations of the Christian source documents of the New Testament, also somewhat of the Old Testament, but they were much more into the New Testament. So... as part of my work, I have to look into the New Testament and look at the original Greek language texts and compare them with Slavic. Given that, I see how they've gotten to be many ways to interpret and reinterpret and comment upon and add lots of stuff around the New Testament,
right,
as well as the Old Testament.
Right, embroider it, constrain it, dismiss it, all sorts
and,
of
and sometimes make it say something directly opposite to what
it
says.
Absolutely.
Like, for example, a bishop should be an upright man, the husband of one wife, and yet there are there are subsets of Christianity mm-hmm. that say a bishop and a priest shouldn't be married at all.
Right.
So that, to my mind, is mistreating the source texts.
Right, or that there, or there, or that. I mean, Phyllis Tribble, who I studied Hebrew Scripture with, Scripture is a commentary on itself, so it also mm-hmm. contradicts itself in critical ways, mm-hmm. and we need to embrace the whole thing. You can't just, you can't impose a structure on it, which conservatives or liberals would like to mm-hmm. do, and you can't, but you can't deny that there's some structure there, but it contradicts itself.
Okay, one of the strands that comes out of reading, especially the Old Testament, mm-hmm. is the idea that man is master, the latest thing to be created, and is supposed to have dominion over the
And again, a term which has ambiguous meanings, which are steward, dominion, master. I mean,
steward is in the New Testament a couple of places, as I recall.
But it's also a very viable interpretation of the Greek, from what I understand.
Yeah.
In the original. Whatever the original means.
But particularly, some of the American Protestant groups seem to feel if we've got dominion, then we can grab everything we want out of nature and mess it up to our heart's content because we're the boss.
Well, I would say that wherever you get that kind of clear-cut stuff, you're also getting the complete conflation of religion, politics, and economics. And it's where you've got a more fully developed or mature religion or a more developed politics, you understand that there's conflict. And that there is no absolute way, and that's when we want to do discussions of this, we need to compare apples and apples, and not apples and oranges, and so I would say, yeah, absolutely.
Well,
but it's all to me a lot of that and this has been something which particularly the conservative Protestants, what we call evangelical Protestants these days, are beginning to come to terms with the damage that they have done. And they are backing off from this kind of triumphalism, which they inherited from liberal Protestantism, which they inherited from an effort to try to secularize society and homogenize education here in the 1800s and the 19th century, which was very damaging. We lost a lot of our diversity. We lost a lot of people having some sense of being the authors of their own lives who ought to be engaged with others. And yes, we need to comply and conform to some extent with others, but we are independent agents.
Well, and careful with that, because the idea that we are independent agents...
we are actors. I overstated it. So we are actors, and we do make choices within contexts. And that's what I'm saying. And when you take away the context that this is what is optimal or this is what is correct, but that is not an inherent quality of religion or of politics or of the economy, but it is an inherent quality of modernity. The optimization justifications by efficiency, rationalizations. We really haven't come to terms with this detour that's produced so much material wealth and well-being, but has damaged our ability to deal with difference.
Okay.
That's my take. That's where I kind of come at it.
Then I hope some of the denominations will gradually become more mature, but they are.
Yeah, and many atheists are actually becoming more mature and much less kind of dogmatic, which I think is that is just a nonsensical debate between theism and atheism. It's just an absolutely nonsensical debate because you have to presume more than anybody could know to answer definitively on either side, so you live with the tension.
Okay. I actually put in one more piece of music.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
The Dies Irae, the medieval hymn.
Sure.
And so maybe you could get that.
And here it is. Do you want to introduce it beforehand or comment on it afterwards?
Okay. This is a medieval hymn written in Latin about Judgment Day. And it is an example of religion leading people to think some truly remarkable and wonderful things, even though they're things that are not really justified in the source texts. So play it, and I'll say a bit more about that.
This is good.
Yes, the medieval hymn, as they say, about Judgment Day. And this, to me, is a wonderful example of how religions lead people to think about things that are not so much in the particular tradition, but the tradition acts as a stimulus. So so the writer of this hymn says about Judgment Day, Liber scriptus proferetur, in quo totum continetur, unde mundus judicetur. Judgment Day, trumpet is going to sound, to bring everyone before the throne. A written book will be brought forward in which everything is contained from which the world will be judged. When the judge takes his seat, nothing will remain hidden. Okay, think about that for a moment. There are about over 7 billion people are alive now, and there are estimates that something like 100 billion people have lived at one time or another during the history of humanity. And so in this view of Judgment Day, a book is going to be brought out, and it's going to tell about each one. You need 37 bits of information to identify each individual person. And now, how many bits of information would you like to be told about you in order for you to be judged? One bit is a yes or no answer. So one bit of information about you would be, is he a good person or not? Yes, no. But I think you would like much more of your own story to be told before you got judged.
Right.
So this would be a book bigger than the galaxies once all the writing was put on it. So.
Right, but that assumes a meaning of judgment. Which there's another attitude towards judgment, which, as in Judaism, the Messiah comes in every generation, within Christianity, the Spirit is there present as at every moment. But judgment can also mean that you come to the instant clarity. You instantly see clearly everything around you, and so everything is made to be real, And it's not about, and when you define it as an end time, mm-hmm. you impose a linear view of history. And within the scriptures, there is both a spiral or circular view of history and a linear view. And the notion that judgment is a human individual experience as opposed to an outside objectified experience, which is the way you just read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it can be taken both ways. The externalized way is, in a sense, nonsense, but the internalized way is a profound, oh, all of this stuff suddenly makes sense, and I didn't get it before.
Let me wish for personal clarity for each person, whether it comes about through their religious studies or some other way.
And one of the nifty things that's very hard for modernists to get their head around mm-hmm. is religious texts are often about extremely detailed descriptions of subjective experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they cannot be objectified. Yet, in a scientific mindset, we read texts as though they were objective statements about reality and don't realize that they're inherently disciplined ways of being subjective. And that is incredibly difficult. It causes a lot of pain and a lot of arguments among people to try to claim one truth over the other when it's just nonsense to have that kind of a battle.
Okay.
And that's my personal
take. I'm going to quote you on that sometime. Yeah,
that's fine. That's fine, because I've been working on this particular issue for close to 40 years.
One further thing. When you work on a particular issue mm-hmm. over 40 years, I hope you can get some other things done in the meantime.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, this is it's you live. You continue. It's just part of the process.
Okay, because there's a danger in that. Too, I always think of Søren Kierkegaard,
mm-hmm.
Who had a perfectly good girlfriend, Regina Olsen,
mm-hmm.
and he jilted her because he was so busy with his spiritual struggles that he didn't think he could marry her and live a normal person's life with her.
Right. And I have never made that choice. I've actually made the compromises in the other directions when at times it would have been wiser for me to take less on than to keep mm-hmm. taking more on. But no, I know exactly the sort of thing. And whether you consider yourself religious or not religious, those are kind of, if you have a structure to life, you have a religion, from my point of view. It's not about, and it's not about supernaturalism. That's kind of an imposition mm-hmm. from outsiders. But it's a way and we also need ways to break down our structures, because mm-hmm. they often become our own prisons, a la Amnesty International. And they cause a lot of damage because we've been wrong. And learning how to be disciplined and humble at the same time is a terribly difficult but important task. And I think that's what you just challenged me to.
Mm-hmm.
And now for kind of our closing conversation, what do you do to restore yourself to some sense of equanimity, optimism, engagement, purposefulness? I don't know what it is that you fall into that isn't good for you that you need to get out of from time. Most people do.
I can say a couple of things. I do have a sort of image that I can bring to mind sometimes, not mm-hmm. always, mm-hmm. And the image is being something like a big sack of sand,
mm-hmm.
and there's a leak in it, and I think of myself as being full of sand and the sand trickling out around my toes somewhere, and the mm-hmm. and the sand are sort of, mm-hmm. is a sort of weight of problems, and so when I can bring that to mind, my problems sort of trickle out.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always work. I don't always think to try and do it, but sometimes mm-hmm. I do. But another thing that happens much more frequently is I'm sitting down and one of our cats comes and jumps up on my lap.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a strong incentive to sit there and not move for
mm-hmm.
a while.
Mm-hmm. Your life has been claimed by the cat.
Yes.
And you're going to give it to the cat.
Yes. And my wife recognizes this.
That's beautiful.
Instead of asking me to bring her something, she brings me something that I can work on.
Yeah.
Cats in general, and this cat in particular, are a strong incentive mm-hmm. to do something different for half an hour, or an hour.
the image of the sand trickling out of the bag, there's an image in 2 Samuel 14:14, which is captured in the Jewish Publication Society of America translation of the scriptures, and it comes something like this. We are like so much water that is poured out upon the ground and cannot be gathered up. But God will not take away the life of one who makes plans that no one may be banished. In that pouring out, we cannot stop it, but we need not banish ourselves or anyone. We are poured out. And this is the woman from Tekoa who's speaking to David, who is longing for his son Absalom, who will come back and lead a revolt. But but the fact is they're fractured, they're dysfunctional, and they cannot deny each other, and they are locked in a future together. And we are in a future together. And at best, we can, in some sense, stop ourselves from being banished or banishing others. That was the image that came to my mind when you, that leaking and letting it go and letting it go out of you. But that may not have been how you intended it.
No, I had a much more physical analogy. If sand trickles out at my toes, then it's no longer in me.
And right, it's gone.
Yeah.
You're free of it. But also, that's how we how we become free of this life, is we go. We go. Do you want to, what would you like to close with this morning?
Okay, well, bring back the theme song, back the Teshoto by the Trio Maiotzi.
And you're listening to the Made of Clay Report. Our guest has been Wales Brown, an enthusiast for languages and things, human rights, and a cook for his partner. Wales, it's been good to get to know you a bit.
Happy to talk to you.